You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the network, its advertisers, owners, or sponsors.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And show prep? What's that? We don't need no stinking show prep.
I'm looking through it, yes. We'll find it here.
So. We're ready. We are ready for our next episode of the M Squared TechCast here at the PodcastDetroit.com network, where we have a heck of a lot of fun and talk about technology and business in Michigan.
And, of course, Jessica, too. We have to talk about her.
Yeah. The Jessica cam will come eventually.
That's right. She's the new, was it, studio manager?
Yep.
Okay.
Whoa,
congratulations.
Big raise. She pulled up in a Ferrari, so I know she's making the big bucks now.
Making bank, baby. Okay, but we do have four great guests for you today. We're going to kick the show off with Jennifer Demud from the Small Business Development Centers of Michigan, and she's talking about a 2030 plan. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be on the show.
Okay, so what can you tell us about the SBDC's plans for the year 2030? Where are we headed in terms of small business formation in the state and support for small business?
Yeah, well, the Michigan Small Business Development Center realized here a few years ago that technology was evolving so fast that we were afraid that many of our small businesses in Michigan weren't able to keep up with the ever-evolving technology and how that industry is impacting how they are going to be doing business in 2030.
So what are some of the trends that you guys are examining for 2030? I'm looking at the your answer already, so I know what they are, but go ahead.
We have lots of people who need the info.
Just a few examples. You know, how is drone technology shifting how small business does business, and how does drone technology impact the ever evolving trends in how we leverage technology? AI, artificial intelligence, absolutely, and then autonomous vehicles, which is a hot topic here in Michigan, and of course cybersecurity. Small businesses are a target for hackers, not just in Michigan, but across the globe. So we're looking at those four areas specifically and how they help small business, but also how it's going to evolve the small business industries in 2030.
And strangely enough, we have IoT Tech Connect coming up on April 4th, and every one of these topics will be explored there. Go ahead, hit the bell. There we go. That's the shameless plug bell. So, and we've invited you guys to join us on some panels, so it'll be lots of fun. But anyway.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that.
Okay.
So what are, basically, what's an example of a small business that the SBDC might work with on these topics?
Yeah, so let's use an example of drone technology. So we have a number of teams at the Small Business Development Center. One team is our tech commercialization team. They would be work with a company, for example, that has advanced some drone technology that we could put some cameras in that drone technology, and they can inspect, we'll say, products that are high in the air or low in the ground that are not easily accessible to an individual. So we can leverage drone technology to not only complete the needed, we'll say, inspections of certain products, but also do it in a much more affordable way.
Okay. And certain AI, I mean, everybody's talking about, gosh, we have all these sensors and things now. We have this incredible database of stuff. How do you sort through the stuff? And everybody's saying AI is the way. Is that kind of what you guys are thinking too?
Yeah, and how do small businesses leverage AI? You know, small businesses, a lot of times, they're busy working in their business and not on their business. You know, leveraging AI and understanding AI can help small businesses develop CRMs that can help compile customer data and identify trends for them. Of course, AI can be used for advanced marketing tactics, as well as AI can help small businesses look at how to retain and capture better customer satisfaction.
And how are you helping small business tap into the whole autonomous vehicle trend?
Yeah, great question. Great question. We've been working with a number of partners as well as stakeholders here in Michigan, looking at the autonomous vehicle industry. University of Michigan is one of our partners in this. Looking at autonomous vehicles, we're bringing on board a mobility specialist. We'll have that position hired within the next few months.
Really?
And that mobility specialist will be charged with helping small businesses identify how they fit in the supply chain for autonomous vehicles. You know, it is a shift if you think of an automotive manufacturer. Or a manufacturer that supplies automotive parts to, we'll say, GM or Ford. This industry that's ever evolving at a very fast pace here in Michigan, you know, we need to make sure that small businesses are in tune with what that industry is going to need so that they can be prepared to work with that industry to be a supplier.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, cybersecurity, that's one of my big bugaboos, is don't connect it if you can't protect it. That's my mantra, you know?
So, I like it.
Certainly that's a big deal too, right?
Yeah, so the Small Business Development Center launched our cybersecurity initiative called Small Biz Big Threat last year. And so far, it's been a huge success. In Michigan, it allows small businesses to understand the threat that's out there for small business, as well as start to prepare their business for a cyber attack. It's inevitable that cyber attacks are going to happen, and we want our small businesses in Michigan to be protected, to be aware and to be protected. Mm-hmm. We also just brought on board a cybersecurity awareness specialist that will be creating awareness internal to the SBDC of the threat to small business, and then providing training to small businesses on that specific topic.
We won't have to ask the Matt question because it sounds like you're hiring like crazy.
We are. You know, we recently hired the cybersecurity specialist, and here in the next few months we'll have our mobility specialist on board. It's an initiative that we feel very strongly about, looking at 2030, again, because small businesses they're in the weeds of their day-to-day business, and we need them to lift their heads up, look forward 2030, and then be prepared for what's out there.
Okay. So let's take a step back here at this point. Let's talk a little bit about the SBDC, its history, and sort of what you do for small business and how small business can plug into those services.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Michigan Small Business Development Center, we're headquartered at Grand Valley State University in Grand Rapids. We have 11 regional centers across the state. Say, for example, Eastern Michigan University, Western Michigan, Lansing Community College, 11 of those regional centers. We have over 90 team members across all 83 counties that are able to help small businesses access services such as one-to-one counsel, training, market research, and that technology commercialization.
You're a much bigger operation than I thought. I didn't realize you had 93 people.
Yes. We'll have 94 once we have our mobility specialists on board. But our organization is essential to Michigan, not just because of the fantastic services that we offer, but also through the collaborations that we have. You know, we like to think in Michigan that there's no wrong door for an entrepreneur or a small business to access our resources here. If the SBDC isn't the right fit for them, there are numerous collaborators, partners across the state that we can refer those businesses to. Hmm. And we help around 11,000 small businesses annually.
Wow.
Yeah, I believe I visited you guys a few years ago on one of my tech tours back when I was working for the radio station. You are in the business building on the downtown Grand Rapids campus, right?
Of the old terminal there, the old railroad terminal, right?
Actually, we moved a few years ago, Mike.
Well, and, haven't been up there in a while, yes.
Yeah, you need to come visit us.
Yes.
We moved into the Sieben College of Business, new building in downtown Grand Rapids.
Yeah, and I think you had just moved in there when I visited. So, yep. So you're up in the business college there, which makes perfect sense since it's business that you provide services to. So what's your role with the SBDC? What's your background?
Yeah, so prior to joining the SBDC, I worked for numerous small businesses ranging from a manufacturer's rep to a contract packager and fell in love with the small business ecosystem. I've been with the Small Business Development Center for just over 10 years.
Wow.
And I am the Associate State Director, so I get to oversee all operations of the statewide organization and help lead this program to successful outcomes, which is small business success.
Now, I do know I'm privy to some news. I don't think it's a secret since he put it on his LinkedIn page, but Keith Brophy is leaving to return to private practice. So I know you have a search on, or you will have a search on for a new state director, right?
We will, and we've so appreciated Keith's leadership over the past 3 years, and it is sad to see him go, but he is transitioning out to private sector, and the exact timeline of when the state director search will occur is yet to be determined. It's expected that position will be posted in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
So in the interim, then, who's the state director?
Yep. So for our interim director is Ed Garner. He's our West Michigan regional director.
Okay. We'll have to get him on the show and have him introduce himself to everybody because these searches typically take a while to reach conclusion, right?
You know, we want to be very deliberate and in the posting, so it will take a good 4 to 6 weeks to post the position. And yeah, it's a significant position for our organization, so taking a little bit of time and to be deliberate and thoughtful with that search is important.
Okay.
So who runs the SBDC of Michigan? How are you folks funded?
Yeah, so we are funded through federal dollars. So that's allocated through Congress. And then we acquire matching funds. Those are typically funds that we acquire within the state of Michigan. So the Michigan Economic Development Corporation provides some financial support to us. And then at our regional centers, provide financial and in-kind support as well. Again, we have the 11 regional centers. So all of those funds pooled together allow us to have the robust expertise across the state to serve small businesses.
Okay, and I see on your webpage here you've got some partners we've all heard of before, like Biotechnology Business Consultants, BBC, the Edward Lowe Foundation, which is the
kitty litter
supporting small business and entrepreneurship, and a whole bunch of other groups and organizations. If people want more information about the SBDC, I noticed the first thing that it invites you to do when you go to your webpage is take a cybersecurity survey, which is a great idea if you have a small business and you haven't thought about it much. So if people want more information, how do they get a hold of you?
Yes, you can go to the website, which is sbdcmichigan.org.
Okay. Thanks very much. We're going to have to leave it there. The segment has come to a close. Jennifer Diemed from the Small Business Development Centers of Michigan in Grand Rapids and their 2030 plan. We'll be right back with another fun-filled segment. For right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you've been listening to the M Squared TechCast.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
As a Lawrence Technological University graduate, you're not only marketable, you're worth more. Yes, more. According to payscale.com, when it comes to graduate salaries, LTU is in America's top 100. Be invaluable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
It's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you are listening to the M Squared TechCast on the PodcastDetroit.com network, where we talk every week for an hour about technology and business in Michigan and tech-based economic development. Right now, our guest is Enrico Schaefer, the drone law expert, whose website, dronelaw.pro, will tell you all you need to know. But Enrico, you're going to update us today. Well, first of all, Enrico, welcome to the show. Let's be polite.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Mike. Good to be here again.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're going to update us on the latest in drone law, drone regulation, and all things drone. I am fascinated by these guys. So why don't you sort of tell us what the latest scoop is?
Yeah, so there's a lot going on in the drone world right now. As you guys know, because I've been on the show before, the FAA about a year and a half ago entered its Part 107 regulation for commercial drone operations, essentially regulating all commercial use of drones under this new regulation. And so there's a very narrow, limited uses that you can use drones for if you're flying for business. And one of the things that's interesting is their Part 107 regulatory approach requires you to go get a waiver from certain rules if you want to do something like fly at night, or if you want to fly in certain airspace that is closer to airports, or if you want to fly beyond visual line of sight. So right now, commercially, and really recreationally, but commercially, you are not allowed to fly your drone beyond your ability to not only see it, but see its altitude, see which direction it's pointing, to be able to have a good view of exactly what its orientation is and in which direction it's headed. If you want a waiver for that kind of thing, you have to go to the FAA and you have to make a safety case saying, hey, I want to be able to fly my drone beyond visual line of sight, beyond my ability to see it. And here's what I propose we're going to do in order to keep that operation safe. Now, the reality is, if Amazon's going to ever deliver your package to your house, it's going to have to fly beyond visual line of sight, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right now you can't do it. The regulations don't allow for it. But as with so many other different little niche areas within commercial drone use, the FAA continues to loosen up its regulatory approach, continues to allow more types of waivers. And of course, some of the bigger companies are getting the most leeway on waivers. Precision Hawk, who's one of the big players in the drone space, they make both drones and a lot of software and data capture and analytics information that go with drones. They've had a very limited beyond line of sight waiver for some time, and now they have a nighttime waiver, which those are being granted routinely. But we are starting to see some more and more traction on allowing different types of operations to occur that may be outside of the standard Part 107 regulations.
And I guess drones are at the Olympics. Maybe I missed that part.
Oh, you didn't see the drones at the Olympics, Mike? Oh, spectacular. So
a lot of that footage had to come from drones, yeah.
Okay. And I saw a whole bunch of synchronization in the sky. You can't tell in Korea what the heck's going on with that. Were those drones?
Those were drones.
No kidding.
So it was, Intel has got really the most robust technology to allow a single operator, a single receiver to control multiple drones, which, again, under Part 107, you can't do that unless you get a waiver. So now we're not in the U.S. and the Olympics, but the reality is that Intel just busted up its own world record for how many drones are being flown by a single operator at the Olympics. And there was a spectacular light show that they did with over 1,200 drones in the air at the same time with a single pilot. Now, of course, these are all pre-programmed routines, and the drones as an alternative to fireworks are a big trend.
Huh.
Because fireworks aren't particularly safe, and they're expensive, and there's so many more different things you can do with drones. So you can't do the five Olympic rings in the sky with fireworks, but you can with drones. If you're Intel, you can't do the Intel logo with fireworks, but you can with drones. And so I encourage everyone to go out and just do a Google search for Winter Olympics drones and look at the video that Intel did. It is absolutely mind-blowing what they programmed these 1,200 drones to do in the sky. And of course, they're lighting up at different times and they're flying in different formations and they can all see each other. They know where they are in the sky in relation to the operator, but also in relation to every other drone that's in the sky.
And what kind of drones were those? It's hard to tell. I mean, now that I think about it, maybe I did see it, but I wasn't sure what I was looking at. But are these little bitty drones, big drones? What were they?
Yeah, so Intel makes its own drones for the purpose of a light show, as do, you know, as do others. But they're very small, very, very light. I can't remember what the weight on them is, but much lighter than your normal DJI drone. And it's just really kind of stripped down to have your GPS system so that it knows where it is in the sky within, you know, an inch or so, and a light system that is going to be controlled, of course, by the algorithm, which is going to tell it when it's going to light and which of tens of thousands of different light variations it can make in the sky. So all of that is happening, from a combination of both the remote pilot on a controller and then computer software that's telling the drones where to go and the lights what to do when they're in the sky. So,
and then how long of a flight time do these things have? Since they're so small, do they fly longer than typical drones?
Usually you're still talking about 15 to 30 minutes, but, ooh, you know, a light show, you know, is going to typically be in that range. Now you can beef them up to go longer than that. And there are certainly drone light shows that are going longer than 30 minutes. There's really one operator in the U.S., Great Lakes Drones. They happen to be out of Grand Rapids that has a competing technology to Intel that's out of a Canadian-based company, has licensed it to Great Lakes Drones. So Great Lakes Drones is going all over the United States right now doing these drone light shows. They've got a waiver for nighttime. They've got waivers for various airspace to be able to do these at events. And they don't have 1,200 drones yet, but they could put, 30, 40, 50 drones in the air and do some really spectacular things for nighttime shows.
So we all know that you're the head of Drone Law Pro. Let me reach for that bell. There we go. So what's the hot legal thing going on right now with drones? What are you battling the most with? I can do it.
Well, you know, it's really getting these drone operators up and running on professional grade contracts and getting them from a startup drone business on into to the next layer. You know, there's not a lot of incidents out there that are creating liability, for instance, so we're not litigating a lot of things. I don't know. Did you guys see the drone footage from the McCarran Airport where the drone is currently being investigated by the FAA, but a drone actually flew right above McCarran, which is totally controlled airspace. You could not fly there legally. Went, saw the jet coming, flew up, I don't know, 50 or so feet above the jet.
Yikes.
And then filmed the whole thing. And the FAA is trying to find that operator.
I'll
and
bet.
You can't do that. And then, of course, we had last week an incident in South Carolina where a plane crashed as a result of it's self-reported at this point. They haven't identified the drone or the operator, but the flight, the pilot and the instructor were doing their flight on their single prop plane, and they said they had to avoid collision with a drone. Ended up hitting a tree and crashing.
Oh my God.
So that's the very first incident we've seen of a drone that may have caused a safety incident with a manned aircraft, which would of course be a terrible thing and a setback for the industry.
Yeah, but it's obviously somebody who's blatantly ignoring all the rules too. So that's yeah, those
exactly.
rules are there for a reason, folks, and this is what happens when you violate them. So yeah, that's crazy. 50 feet.
Yeah, it's really not something that most people would even think of doing, but there are a lot of idiots out there who think, oh, I've got this drone, I'm going to go film by aircraft. You cannot get anywhere near aircraft with a drone. And I don't care if it's commercial or recreational, the FAA will come after you. And the penalties can be really severe, including to $250,000 in criminal fines and 3 years in jail.
Well, I suspect if they find either of these culprits, that's exactly what they're going to do to make an example of them, right?
It would not be surprising, Mike, because what we've seen throughout the history of drones in the FAA is the FAA doesn't have the resources to find all the violators and to investigate all the incidents, right? So when they do get something that really can act as a lesson for the community and can get press so that it ends up in the headlines, they take advantage of it because they want their best safety avenue is to get a incident in the front page of the newspaper where someone's having to suffer a consequence from an unlawful or unsafe drone flight.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the state now? Are you in Traverse City today? I know you're something of a globe hopper, but
he's a jet setter, actually. So
today I'm in Traverse City for a couple more days and I'm off to Portland, Oregon. And then I'm starting travel all the way through May.
Okay. So who's doing, I'm just curious, it being someone who used to live up north, who's doing the most interesting stuff with drones in northern Michigan? It strikes me that that's a place where, because it's kind of lightly populated without a lot of air traffic, you could actually test this stuff up there. Is anybody doing anything like that?
There's some really interesting stuff going on in town. There's a company called Aviopt, which has created a testing facility and some rural property where they've got a really great flight control center. And they allow companies to come out and do test flights at their facility, which can be things such as putting up drones to be able to shoot a laser to be able to identify line of sight for a cell tower. So right now, if you want to put up cell towers, what they do is they send people out in trucks. Those trucks then have aerial telescoping aerial items on there where they can send people up, and then they look to see if they can see the other truck with the other person. And then, because these cell towers have to be able to have line of sight. Well, you could actually put a drone up at whatever, 100 feet or 150 feet, send a laser out, which will stop at an exact distance and altitude. So it not just shoots forever, it goes until this point, and then it can determine line of sight here, then the drone can turn line of sight there. So you could really start to see where to put the cell towers. And you can imagine what kind of cost savings that is.
Yeah, tremendous.
Tremendous, right? And those are the little things that drones are going to do. I mean, we're all kind of like, every time there's a new technology, everyone gets all worked up. Oh my God, cell phones, someone's going to bring them in a restroom. Well, does anyone even think about that anymore? No, right?
I hear it all the time, actually.
Well, everyone except Matt, right? Matt's still thinking about that.
He hasn't
been able to go to the bathroom for 4 years now.
But he's been holding it.
Without hearing someone else's personal details, right?
Exactly. But as the technology starts to get more evolved and starts to offer those benefits like, bringing you a package within 2 hours of your Amazon order, then people forget about that kind of stuff. And the safety that's getting baked into drones on a technology level is just insane.
Well, Amazon is experimenting in the UK right now with package delivery, but I know they have different rules over there, right?
Yeah, so there are a lot of the big players like Amazon, et cetera. They go to countries where the regulations are less or the government is being more permissive about allowing certain types of flight. So, for instance, we have a client that's doing a $5 million agricultural spraying job in Sri Lanka, which is they do tea. 90% of their gross national product is tea. Hmm. Well, right now they send a bunch of people out with backpacks and pesticides. You can do that with drones. And it's a lot safer and a lot faster and a lot cheaper. But you couldn't do that in the United States yet. It would, the regulations really don't allow for it.
Okay, Enrico, we've reached the end of the segment. Tell people how to get a hold of you, please.
You can contact Enrico Schiffer at dronelaw.pro. That's dronelaw.pro. And you could find me there, and we'd be happy to talk to you if you have any drone-related issue.
Okay, and it's Enrico Schiffer. That's S-C-H-A-E-F-E-R.
All right, just like Schaefer Road and Schaefer Highway.
Also known as, Traverse City, Enrico Traverse City on Facebook or something, right? So,
exactly, Enrico Traverse.
That's what it is. I knew it was some variation of that. So.
Okay, thanks, Enrico. Yeah. We'll talk to you again soon. For right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M-Squared TechCast.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed.
Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunities. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch on the M Squared TechCast, proudly part of the PodcastDetroit.com network, and my partner in crime here, Mike Brennan, is taking his seat right now. He's back.
He's back.
Okay. And our next guest on today's show is a longtime friend of the M Squared TechCast, Maley Ostale. So, Maley, tell folks your business address and all that good stuff to get started here.
Hey, guys. It's wonderful to be back on the show. Thank you very much for having me. This is Maley Ostale from, and I'm the CEO of Smart Finds Marketing. You can find us at smartfindsmarketing.com.
And, well, you have offices around the world, but the primary one's in Birmingham, Michigan. So there is a local connection, although I know you are in Europe as we speak.
Yeah, that's for sure. I'm certainly all over the board nowadays. I had a friend of mine recently mentioned to me, he goes, you know, you sound like James Bond. You're like in Mallorca and you're in Istanbul and then you're over in Bulgaria and Germany. And I'm like, yeah, I agree. It sounds that way, doesn't it?
I think it's just your cover story and you really work for a three-letter organization, but we won't name them. So anyway, that'll get you in trouble, boy.
No doubt. Yeah. Certainly will.
So let me, some disclaimers here. Maley and I work real closely together. He's my social media partner. And so a couple years ago, you transformed my website and all my social media marketing, and we've done really pretty well with that. In fact, he's working on redeveloping my website as we speak, and in a month or so from now, we'll be able to show you the new and improved MI Tech News. Right, Maley?
Oh, great.
Yes, I would agree. You know, I think a lot of businesses need to keep in mind that they literally need to revamp their website almost every 18 months. I know that sounds crazy, but, you know, especially when you think about the fact that the average website takes anywhere from 3 to 6 months. But, you know, technologies change very quickly. Designs change very quickly. It's just like the fashion industry. And businesses need to stay on top of these things on an ongoing basis. So, we'll have the new MI Tech News website up in about a month.
Okay. And the other thing that we're working on, another disclaimer, I'm actively involved in this. I'll let you describe it because I call it a conquest car program and you don't really like to call it that. So what do you want to officially call it?
Yeah, let me start off by saying, you know, just to recap what we've mentioned about this program before. This is a Smart One, which is specifically designed for auto dealerships. It is a marketing program more so than it is a technology program. The issue with the word conquest when it comes to auto dealerships is the fact that these tools have been predominantly sold by technology companies. And it's been about 5 years or so. In the past 5 years, these tech companies have overpromised and underdelivered and have a lack of consistency in their results. We've taken this project to this type of service, if you want to call it, or solution, to a different level. We say, hey, look, let's take technology, just consider the tech guys as our printers of the old world, and let's figure out how to use the technology that they have, but let's overlay it with a marketing strategy, a process, and marketing activities. And by the time it gets said and done, you have a six-pronged approach instead of a 1-3-pronged approach when it comes to what I call hyper-local marketing for a dealership. And so we started Smart One, and, you know, obviously we're based out of Detroit. How can you avoid the automotive industry if you're based in Detroit. And we've been working with car dealerships since actively since 2010, and we started into the auto industry back in 2006. Projects we've worked on include Penske Automotive Group all the way to the local dealerships out west, for the most part. Smart One, currently we have some interesting projects on board. We have one with Suburban Cadillac of Ann Arbor. We have a lot of specials going on with this program in that area. We have another one going on with Crown Motors, which is the Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram location in Holland, Michigan. And these are two active projects. We've had some great success. We've had a pretty decent success with the Cadillac one, if I may say so.
Yes, and they're experimenting with different types of vehicles, Cadillac being more upscale, and then the one in Crown is Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge, and a few other things, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the Suburban Cadillac project, since the Cadillac project and Cadillac dealership and the Chevrolet dealership are side by side, and if you add to this process the fact that a lot of dealerships have used cars from other brands on their lot as well that they're trying to get rid of. In the Suburban Cadillac project, we actually have sold, we guaranteed them 20 cars that we're going to sell. To date, we've sold 27. Seven of them are non-brand vehicles that they normally sell, which meaning that it's not Cadillac or Chevrolet. And then the other 20 are a mix of Chevrolet and Cadillac. And we've been able to achieve that in 6 weeks, about 5 to 6 weeks. We have about 3 weeks left in that project, and we're pretty sure we're going to hit above 30 by the time we're said and done.
And Millie and I have been discussing expanding the sales force. We do have a couple of folks we're talking to right now, one down in Florida, one right here in good old Detroit. We were saying this might be an excellent program for anybody that's like a retired auto person that has all those connections that wants to augment their pension a little bit. This could be really interesting program for them, you think?
Yeah, it might be. You bring up an interesting point. Ever since we got into the automotive industry, as we set our foot, especially at the dealership level, now the tier three level as of 2010, it is evident that unless you know the general manager or somebody close within the dealership, it's not likely, whether you're a marketing company, a tech company, or otherwise, that you're going to sell into that dealership. And so most of the general managers are my fellow baby boomers. Most of the people they know tend to be baby boomers. So I would agree with you that if there are baby boomers out there who are looking for secondary income or looking for a sales avenue into the car dealership world, we're certainly open to talking to more people about getting Smart One out there.
So mainly I'm a baby boomer, and I for my cars, at least I buy, usually small ones, and drive them into the ground. I typically own them for like 10 or 12 years. My wife, on the other hand, doesn't drive nearly as much. So we lease her car, and we just go in every 2-3 years, depending on how long the lease is. And we go, we sit at the dealership and go see and talk to a dealer. How is this going to change my life in terms of that, every 2 or 3 year visit to replace the lease car?
I think from the consumer standpoint, I don't know that it's going to change anything.
Okay.
This is less about the consumer and more about how the dealership is marketing to the consumer. The consumer's marketing process has changed. Opening up a newspaper and looking at a full page ad just doesn't work anymore.
Right.
Getting a mailer in the mail, forget it. That's that's just junk mail. Listening to it on a radio or a TV spot, not happening. So from that standpoint, the dealerships are constantly looking for new avenues in the digital world to reach the consumer. The question is, how do you reach them? And, as you can imagine, most dealerships tend to focus on individual marketing segments instead of looking at the entire picture. So it's literally, it's about, okay, I got my email, I have Facebook, I've got Google, I've got press releases, because the news networks tend to be the number one read area on the internet. I've got social media, I've got content marketing, I can pull an inbound marketing strategy around this. And so from that standpoint, it's about taking all of this, all of these activities, these marketing activities, pulling them into one solution and driving the consumers to be aware of the specials, the news, and the used cars that they have available to them.
And it's a very large campaign. For instance, the Suburban campaign targets, what, 100,000 email addresses. So even if we only get a 2% yes. click rate, that's still 2,000 people, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. One of the things about the Smart One program is because we have access to the Polk data, meaning that our foundation is based on the data that of everybody who's purchased a car, their make, their model, their year, their VIN number, what dealership, where region, their address, et cetera, we're able to target people within a, let's say, 20-mile radius or 25-mile radius of the dealership. And most of those numbers tend to be around the 100,000 consumers that we can reach from the dealership. Recently, we had a situation down in Florida where the numbers were actually at 400,000, which is very interesting. But yes, around the country, we have access to a very large database of consumers that we can target. And this is why we call it a hyper-local targeting project or a marketing program, is that we're very specific on demographics and as well as make, you know, what type of brand people tend to flock to. So, you know, if you're a Cadillac dealership and you wanted to target more Mercedes people, well, we will have that ability to do that.
Oh, sorry, I just sat back down.
Okay.
It's one of those days, you know. So. So let's tell folks where they can find out. I'm going to be down about 2 minutes, Jess. Yep. Yep, she's giving me the two. All right, our peace sign. I'm not sure which. So let's talk a little bit more now. If folks want to find out more about Smart One, we got some auto dealers out there listening or whatever. How do they do that?
So first of all, let's visit our website for our company, which is smartfindsmarketing.com. The other thing is that within that website, we have pages dedicated to these dealerships around the auto industry. However, alternatively, dealerships can reach us at smartonedealers.com. And I think that'll be the best way to contact us. Certainly, I'm on LinkedIn with my close 13,000 friends that I got over there. And feel free to contact me by email, which is maily@smartfindsmarketing.com. My first name is spelled M-E-L-I-H.
Yep. And then if that doesn't work, you can reach out to me since I'm working with him here in Michigan in the Great Lakes. One has to diversify one's income, doesn't one?
Yes, you know, so. And everybody knows how to reach Mike.
It's absolutely.
MITechnews.com.
That's it. My last name, Brennan, at MITechnews.com, and you can get us both, and we'll fix you right up. So, well, cool. We're excited about this program. We think it's, you know, just take a little while for it to get some legs here, but by summertime or fall, we could be really cooking, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, as we move through this process, because the conquest programs or hyper-local marketing programs for dealerships have just started to, with the new technology that's come about within the last 5 years. And as new technologies come, you know, it's a spiral process. It evolves, it develops, it improves. And I think we've reached a point where, at the end of the day, the results show that this works, at least nowadays. I don't know about 5 years ago.
All right. Thanks a lot, Maily. We'll have to leave it there. Maily Ostale, Smart Finds Marketing. For right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast.
Lawrence Technological University is more than a school. It's a launchpad for your future, offering industry-leading facilities and 100-plus programs that are ranked among the nation's best. Be unstoppable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Roush.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with our final segment for the day on the M Squared TechCast on the PodcastDetroit.com network.
And I'm going to try to pronounce it right. I have this reputation for butchering everyone's name. John Muse? Mm-hmm. Did I get it right? Okay. He's, I'm not sure if you're a partner. Are you a partner?
No.
Did you want to be a partner?
Sure thing.
Okay, Joe's listening. So, Joe, make him a partner at Warner, Norcross, and Judd. And you're going to be talking about the regulatory environment for autonomous vehicles.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, we're hearing a lot about the technology. Rewind.
Okay.
Much too much going on in my life for today.
Foster will fix it in post.
Yes, he will. All right. Foster, here we go. So we're hearing a lot about the technology to enable autonomous cars is within grasp. However, the regulatory environment to support these cars on the road is lagging. What a big surprise that is, huh? Can you give us an update?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true that the development of automated and connected driving technology has outpaced the development of the regulatory environment for those technologies. You see Audi rolling out its flagship A8 this year, which will be the first commercially available Level 3 autonomous vehicle. Manufacturers, including those that are skipping Level 3, project the release of Level 4 capable vehicles by 2021.
Yeah.
But keep in mind that 3 or 4 years ago, they were saying 2018 or 2019 was the target. So it's a moving target. And of course, Level 2 vehicles, so not full, you know, not with the driver ceding any control yet, but that have some of these features enabled. So Tesla's Autopilot, GM's Super Cruise, and Volvo's Pilot Assist are all available on vehicles today, which, you know, they control the speed and steering functions. But even when operating those functions, the human driver is still primarily responsible. So meanwhile, of course, the legal and regulatory environment is definitely still in its early stages. In the U.S., we have no federal legislation nor any binding administrative rules governing these vehicles or their operation on public highways. And in fact, federal regulations still affirmatively require a steering wheel and a gas pedal, among other things. So a Level 5 vehicle isn't even really possible at this point without a special exemption. At the state level, you've got 9 states and D.C. that have passed laws that actually expressly authorize the deployment of these vehicles on public roads beyond just for testing purposes. That said, and most experts agree, that these vehicles are legal, even without a statute specifically saying so, except in New York, where there's a 1971 law still on the books that actually requires a driver to have one hand on the steering wheel at all times. So,
and a horse in front of the car, right?
So. Yeah, so might as well. And this is just how it always goes with new technology. If you look all the way back to, you know, the printing press, Gutenberg invented his in the mid-1400s and sparked a huge debate on the ownership of ideas, but the first copyright statutes weren't enacted until the 1700s in Great Britain.
Hmm.
In the more modern history of automobiles, airbags were offered in U.S. models starting in the early 1970s. Then they were pulled back. Then they were rolled out again in the 1980s. And it wasn't until 1991 that Congress actually passed legislation to require airbags for new cars.
And seatbelts. Seatbelts. When I was a kid in the 60s, I wore a seatbelt and everybody else didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was before you had to wear a seatbelt, or it had to be, what, the three-point or whatever it's called?
Yes.
With shoulder harness, all that jazz?
Yep.
And then they mandated that. That took 20 years or so, right?
Right. And I think that's how it should be, too. The law is at its best and its most legitimate when it sort of reflects and incorporates the results of a robust public debate.
And evolving technology
right,
as well.
Right, yeah. Exactly. The last thing you would want is you know, a set of laws that ends up being irrelevant or misguided because new advancements in technology, you know, make those laws kind of meaningless. So developers of automated vehicles, especially those that are new to the industry, the auto industry, who aren't as familiar or comfortable with the whole regulatory and liability burdens placed on automakers, they probably want some certainty of a comprehensive set of rules that can dictate how these vehicles are designed or rolled out. But I think the law should do its best to stay out of its own way for now.
Let me leap in one follow-up. Where are we in Michigan? Where do we stand on this?
Yeah, so Michigan actually is Governor Snyder, MDOT, and the state legislature have all been active and forward-thinking compared to other states. And of course, they need to be this way because the auto industry is such an important economic driver for this state.
And the governor's one tough nerd, so he understands this stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so. Yeah.
So who are the like small and mid-sized Michigan companies you know, who are involved in this industry? What's happening here in our state?
Yeah, so there's some collaborative engagements going on right now at a higher level that have been inclusive, I think, of the smaller and mid-sized tech companies. You look at M-City, which is the public-private partnership operated in Ann Arbor on U of M's North Campus that has affiliate members of all sizes. The biggest funders, of course, are the ones with the biggest checkbooks, but that facility in particular has been very inclusive in terms of opening its testing facilities for companies of all sizes, including those smaller companies.
Okay. In Europe, are they doing anything differently with this or in Asia? How do we compare to, say, different places around the world?
Yeah, well, so one thing about the U.S. is we have the whole federal and state dynamic where the feds dictate safety standards for the design of vehicles, and the states, you know, generally speaking, the states cover licensing and, you know, vehicle codes in terms of how they operate on the roads, the mm-hmm. rules of the road, mm-hmm. and licensing drivers and insurance. So there's this kind of split of roles that you don't always see in certain other countries. In Europe, also, the whole regulation of vehicle design is handled differently in the sense that in the U.S., we have a set of federal safety standards that all vehicles on the road have to comply with, but manufacturers just certify themselves that by putting them into this, you know, by selling them into the market, they are certifying themselves that they comply.
Yeah.
In Europe, you actually have to get approval beforehand from the regulators that says, okay, this meets all of our standards and can now be sold.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, Europe has kind of had to, you know, scramble a little bit. They've had to move more quickly on automated vehicles just as a necessity, and are actually scrambling to keep up with the Audi A8 that's level 3 capable that I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we've only got so much time. I don't want to dive down the European rabbit hole too far, but I did actually advise one of our clients recently on the current and proposed requirements for certain autonomous driving features. So if any listeners want to know more, they can feel free to reach out offline.
Okay. Matt, you got one?
Well, I'm just wondering. Today we had a company in Ann Arbor, May Mobility, announce that they'd raised $11.5 million in venture capital, including the venture capital investing arms of BMW and Toyota. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit. And, you know, I mean, there's obviously strong investor interest in this industry. So it's, I mean, something's coming, right? I mean, our question is always how far away? How far away? How long? You know?
So. Yeah. You know, as the lawyer, I'm not going to speculate on the risks that go into launching a new product and how quickly and how feasibly from a technical side of things that can be done. But yeah, it's a hot space right now. You've got entire venture capital firms being formed in town that are just focused on the mobility industry. So it's a hot, it's definitely a hot area of investment right now. Now, you know, the regulation, of course, isn't there yet. So in the meantime, in this area of all this uncertainty, it comes down to those negotiations between smaller companies developing these innovative technologies and their customers or their suppliers, as far as allocating the risk of liability and of any type of regulatory issues that might come up.
Mm-hmm.
So what advice would you provide, explain to tech companies that are in this space, what should they be doing? I mean, because everybody's trying to leap in here and, you know, a little caution might be good, right?
Yeah. With automobiles, it's a type of product that tech companies aren't used to making.
Oh, yeah.
A type of product that can cause serious harm when something goes wrong. Yep. You know, if my phone crashes in my pocket, oh well.
Or hopefully it doesn't catch on fire.
If it catches on fire, right, you're right. You got me there. If it catches on fire, that's a whole other issue.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure Samsung's got an army of lawyers still dealing with that. But, they're not accustomed to the type of risk that auto companies are in selling cars to the market that can cause serious harm. So it's this new area of liability for tech companies, and product liability is a little bit different in every state. So whereas the largest automakers all have small armies of lawyers who are used to defending lawsuits in all 50 states alleging that some kind of defect in their vehicle caused an injury. And I'm sure Google and Apple and Amazon won't have any problem with that. But it's the smaller and mid-sized tech companies that can't really afford the expense of constantly defending those lawsuits. So at the end of the day, it's about contracting. And especially so when there's still so much legal uncertainty and regulatory risk involved with developing this technology. So contracts are, at the end of the day, a means of allocating risk between the two parties that are involved. And typically we've seen, joint development agreements, licensing agreements, some kind of supply contract, or even sometimes a joint venture. But there's always some kind of document between the supplier of some kind of game-changing technology and the party that's ultimately incorporating it into a final product or that's doing something else with it and developing its set of components. Whatever it is, there's some piece of paper that allocates the risk for what goes wrong with the potential of, harm that could happen.
Yeah, because now people are talking about, so the autonomous vehicle crashes into something, who knows, God forbid, they kill somebody. Who's responsible?
Yeah, who do they sue?
Probably the one with the deepest pockets, right?
That's, yeah.
Well, they sue everybody, yeah. Right?
Everybody. There's actually a case making its way through federal court right now in California that involved a crash between a GM Cruise Bolt being driven in its autonomous mode with a test driver in the driver's seat, but as California law requires still, that was in the center lane in a three-lane city street headed into downtown San Francisco. Mm-hmm. It was in the center lane. The human driver, that is,
right,
told the vehicle to make a left lane change by, deploying the left turn signal. These are the allegations, at least. I'm going to put my lawyer disclaimer.
Allegedly, this
right,
is what
right,
happened.
Right, right, right. Thank you. initiated the lane, the car to make the lane change itself, which you can do is say just hit the left turn signal and it'll do the lane change itself. He had done that, and the car had started to move and had sensed, the vehicle in front on the left lane. And the vehicle coming up from behind in the left lane, that there was enough space there for it to make a safe lane change. Well, the car coming up from behind was started to accelerate such that the car decided, no, it's not safe anymore. So midway through the lane change, came back into the center lane. Mm. Meanwhile,
that's what happens to me every time I try to change lanes.
Yeah.
If there's somebody behind you,
on the way here,
they floor it once they know you want that space.
Right.
He's just an old driver, so that's different.
And that's what happened here. But in California, also, lane splitting by motorcycles is legal. So the motorcyclist who was in the center lane had seen this lane change about to happen, but decided, whether it changes lanes or not, I'm going to split the center and right lanes pass on the right.
Oh.
And it was when the car headed back into the center lane after aborting its lane change that the motorcyclist was hit. Not seriously harmed, but hurt enough that he wanted to sue.
I'll bet.
So that could actually be a sort of Kitty Hawk moment for auto accident attorneys that are going to be looking at that very closely to see what kind of principles come out of it. Of course, it could settle, and we'll get no real legal principles articulated by a judge in that case, or
well, that's it. There's no precedent at this point, right?
Right. You know? So that would be precedent unless it gets settled out of court. So we'll see what happens.
All right, we've reached the end of the show, John. We're going to have to leave it there.
No,
John,
in about 3 minutes, I think. I just got to 3 minute sign, right, Jessica?
No? I've got 3 o'clock.
No.
So. Nope.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. It's my smartphone. It hasn't been very smart today.
Okay. So that's John Muse from Warner Norcross and Judd. You can reach him at 248-784-5165 or J Muse, that's JMUHS at WNJ.com. Want to thank John and all of our guests today, Meili Ostale from Smart Finds
Marketing in Birmingham.
Enrico Schaefer from Drone Law Pro up in Traverse City, and Jennifer Diemann from the Small Business Development Centers. Good show today. Nice mix.
Well, we try.
Okay. We'll be back again next week at 2 o'clock Eastern time. For right now, this is Matt Roush.
And Mike Brennan.
And you've been listening to the M Squared TechCast.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Roush and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.